Talks with
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Rather than moving us into a post-racial era, President Obama's election seems to have stirred up racial issues that have been simmering on the back burner for far too long. From time to time, what's simmering boils over, sometimes with tragic consequences. But at least these incidents provoke a renewed conversation about race and racial inequality and America's troubled relationship with both. Ideally, we wouldn't require tragic incidences to have those conversations, and that's something our guest this hour has been working on for a very long time. Stephanie Robinson is a practicing attorney, a lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, a national media figure who has worked frequently with Tom Joyner and Tavis Smiley, and is president and CEO of the Jamestown Project. That's a national think tank focusing on democracy. She's coming to Charlotte to meet with local leaders and with hundreds of school children. She'll be speaking about race next week to middle school children at Trinity Episcopal, but it'll be a group of kids from all over the system during the day and to the community at large on the evening of January 22nd. And Stephanie Robinson joins us in advance to share her thoughts on race inequality and what we can do about it from studios at Harvard University. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, first of all, we've had a chance to chat a little bit before this program starts, and you're a lot of fun.
I like that. I need to be a lot of fun if I'm going to talk to over 250 middle schoolers on next Thursday, right?
And loud, evidently.
And loud.
Before we talk about race, let's talk about you. You're one of those rare people whose views are sought after by very disparate media outlets, from the Washington Post and NPR to Fox News. And for 5 years, you were a political commentator for the very popular Tom Joyner Morning Show, talking about topical issues. How did this happen for you? Is this something that you set out to do, or did somebody just discover you?
I think that I was destined to do these things. I mean, it's funny you asked that question. I think about who I am, and we're going to talk a lot about identity when we talk about these issues of race and individuality next Thursday as well. But I think about who I am, and now I see myself as this 21st century woman, and that means all women out there know what that means. It means that I wear a whole lot of hats, and we play a lot of roles. But early on in life, my mother always said, I think God just made you this way. You care deeply about people. You care deeply about causes. Issues of justice, what's fair and what's right has always been a part of who I am. And I think that I started out wanting to go to law school ultimately because I wanted to give a voice to the voiceless. I wanted to be able to understand the laws and the regulations that really guide our country and I would say even our world. And I wanted to be able to understand them in a way that I could help those who are oftentimes disenfranchised, disaffected, or simply uninterested, figure out how they can engage in all of this. And I think that it started that way, quite frankly. You said I'm president and CEO of the Jamestown Project, but that came about, this national think tank really came about when I was chief counsel for Senator Edward M. Kennedy, late Senator Kennedy. I'm a lawyer by training, but I worked for Senator Kennedy for over 6 years down in Washington, D.C., and I worked on issues of all of his domestic policy, from health care to education to the budget issues to racial disparities in health care system. I was able to go on the first envoy over to work on AIDS in Africa or AIDS people who were orphaned because of AIDS. And so all of this work, I think, that was planted in me very, very early in my life, led me to want to be able to be a part of the system, wanting to be able to figure out ways both inside and outside of the system, being able to impact it and affect it. And part of it is, I think, that I started the Jamestown Project because I was leaving. We were moving up to Connecticut, and I wanted to do a project that took academics, it took people who were in politics, and it took real people and brought them together to really be able to understand our democracy, to be able to engage in these issues. And out of that, a lot of connections happened for me. I was able to continue not only from my national platform and my earlier experience with all of the people, the wonderful Kennedy clan that I know and love and others, but I was able to really travel the country and work on the ground and meet people. And I happened into meeting Tavis Smiley. And Tavis and I did a lot of work early on the Covenant with Black America. I did a lot of work with him on the state of the State of the Black Union when he was working on doing that work. And I think that that was the platform that allowed me really to not only hone in on this issue of race and inequality and social justice from a more global perspective, but really to understand it and be able to talk more to the people who it was really impacting, and these were communities of color. And from that, I went to Tom Joyner and continued to do this work. So, I mean, I've been extraordinarily blessed. I love the work that I've been able to do. And I really do think that it's a calling. I think that you have to work hard with it, that you have to listen to people, that you have to have a passion and a compassion. And that's what I do.
You mentioned that your mother says that this was kind of born in you. And I know that you have been involved in politics at some level since you were a child, as a matter of fact. And you said you worked for Senator Kennedy. And he was one of the last lions of the progressive movement. When we lost Senator Kennedy, the progressive people lost, I think, a great mouthpiece and a great activist for their cause. And a lot of this progressive point of view, at least as expressed by Democrats, held sway for a very long time. And now, it's kind of lost the ear of the American people. Its influence has been eroded. Why do you think that has happened? When there is, I would imagine, I'm going to put words in your mouth here, when there is other work to be done.
No, I absolutely think that there's other work to be done. This started happening. I don't know if it's just the American people. I think it's the institutions. And the American people tell you this. When you see the surveys and when you see the polling data about the amount of trust, the amount of respect that they have, that the American people have for these institutions that are to supposed to be protecting us, guiding us, working for us. I think that you have to not necessarily look to the American people so much as to look to the institutions and the people who are in these places right now. And I would say that Senator Kennedy was, I mean, he was an extraordinary human being, and he was a human being. And I like to say that's the piece I like to say about Martin and anyone else who's iconic historical figures in our country's history. But he didn't just sort of do the mouthpiece thing, right? People always think of him as this liberal lion, and he did it. I mean, he understood what his role was. But he was extraordinarily smart. He was a workhorse. He understood that you can't just pound your chest and get things done, that you have to look to both sides, quite frankly, and really look in the middle as well. He built relationships with people on both sides of the aisle. He treated everyone, whether it was a senator or a congressman or the president of the United States, he treated everyone with a certain amount of respect. But he also treated, you know, his staff. He treated the person who was opening the car doors. He treated the person who he knew the names of all of the people who worked the elevators in the Senate. I mean, he was a type of person who cared deeply about people. And I think when you care about people, when you really care about people, and when you understand that while you may be right, it's not always best to be right. It's sometimes best to listen and understand and empathize with the other side and to be smart about it and understand that you do have to roll up your sleeves and work. I think that if people did that more in Washington, D.C. And more on a lot of these outlets and stopped sort of yelling at each other and talking over each other, that the American people, because this is a lot of what they see, this is what their national appetite or their national diet has been. It's the oxygen that they continue to breathe. And people turn off to that. They're like, I don't want to hear what the progressives have to say. I don't know, you know, progressive, liberals, small d, big d. I don't know what it is anymore. And I honestly don't want to hear what all the Republicans and the conservatives have to say. And so you have this sort of stalemate and you have this disinfection or disaffectedness that's happening with the American people who are like, I don't want to deal with it at this level anymore. And Mike, I think that there's a difference, right, between dealing with it at the level of national politics and dealing with it at a local level. And it's part of why I'm so excited about going to Charlotte and being able to talk to people at this Freedom Fete event where Trinity hosts this. It's a celebration of Martin Luther King Day, but it's dedicated to celebrating the work of those who lead the struggle for civil justice and for social justice on the ground. And so there are people, I mean, evidenced by what we see in the streets right now, there are people who are saying, when things are impacting me, I'm working at home, I'm working in my community, I'm working at my school board, I'm doing the work of the people. So I'm not impacted so much and I'm not turned off. I'm doing work and I don't know if I have to put a P at the top of it for progressive or a L or, you know, what I have to do with that. But since I don't feel like I'm getting the leadership from the top so much anymore, I'm going to continue to do what I need to do, you know, in my community.
Well, when you come to places like Charlotte and you speak to groups of people like this for particular events, it seems to me that in some ways you are preaching to the choir. These are people
Absolutely.
Who are already connected. However, one of the things that you have been able to do, I'm told, with some success, is connect or reconnect people to politics. How do you do that?
You know, I think that you do it at a lot of spaces. Let me talk about it kind of generally, and then I'm imagining you're talking about sort of part of what we do from or part of what the work that we do at Jamestown, where we are. Our mission is to make democracy real, and we do this by looking at five broad strategies and thinking about how we achieve this mission. We you know, are generating new ideas. We're thinking about what's going on, what's happening on the bottom, what's happening at the grassroots level. We're promoting meaningful conversations and public conversations and engagement. And that piece of it, in giving people a place and a space to be able to talk and have their voices heard, that's essential. That is crucial to any sort of real and meaningful and lasting civic participation. And we also look to cultivating new leaders. I mean, this is the piece of it that has to do with middle school diversity conferences. So it's important. It's extraordinarily important. And Trinity Episcopal School gets it. They're like, we're going to bookend this day. We're going to first start with the young people because, quite frankly, as we have learned from our history, they are on the front lines. They are at the heart. They are the energy. They are the people who are inheriting everything that we're leaving them right now. So we're going to start there. And we're going to work with them in cultivating them and then having them understand this. And we're going to also continue to connect this up with the people who are still doing this very important work today. So I can't speak enough about how you cultivate new leaders. And it's not just young people. It's people who really haven't thought about this before, who may get, like, you know, a bee in their bonnet about a particular issue. And you talk to them and you figure out and you strategize with them and you bring them together with others so that they feel like they're not alone so that they can do this work.
Well,
and then you look.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, finish.
No.
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, I mean, I think, and the other thing is that you have to formulate strategy. You have to understand what is real and what is not and what you can do and what you can't do. But I would say that humility is part of what drives me, and knowing that I don't know everything, and being ready and able to say that, and really allowing people who have been doing this work a place and a space to be able to cultivate it and do it, and let them know that they're important.
We only have about 40 seconds left. Maybe this is unfair to ask in that time, but I was going to ask, when you have these dialogues, these community public dialogues, who's talking and who's listening? More importantly, who is listening?
I think that I am listening. I think that the people who we bring in, the people who are the quote-unquote experts, are listening. And I learned that that lesson from working on the Hill and not being so effective. You got to listen. You can't sit there and do all the daggone talking. You got to listen to what's being said.
Stephanie Robinson is a lecturer at Harvard Law School. She's also the president of the Jamestown Project. She will be in town on January 22nd at Trinity Episcopal to talk to students first, the public at large second. Information about all of that is on our website at WFAE.org. And we're going to come back and talk about race in America. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and McGay Shepherd, CFP, Senior Vice President of Investments at Stifel Nicholas & Company, Incorporated. The Shepherd team provides wealth management based on educating clients and planning their financial futures. McGayShepherd.com. Well, at a time when the music industry is undergoing mammoth changes, Charlotte is becoming a little more prominent in the industry. For a long time, most rap, hip-hop, R&B has come out of Atlanta, closely followed by New York and L.A., as you might imagine. But now, Charlotte is making headway, and we will be the site of the upcoming Southeastern Music Conference, which gets underway, I believe, tomorrow. We're going to meet some of the people writing and recording rap, hip-hop, and R&B here and find out more about this conference tomorrow at 9.
On the next I and Reem show, the UN is pressing Nigerian officials to investigate a possible mass killing by Boko Haram militants, the brutal insurgency, and new calls for international intervention.
Join the Diane Reem Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Stephanie Robinson today, the president of the Jamestown Project, who is coming to town to talk about race inequality and what we can do about it. So let's talk about that. The U.S. has had a tortured relationship with race, which dates back to its very beginnings, hence the name of the Jamestown Project, I believe, that you're involved in. We profess these democratic ideals of equality. At the same time, we enshrine slavery into the fabric of the Republic's beginnings. And then, though slavery and Jim Crow are long gone, the scars remain. We have our first African-American president, but his presence in the White House seems to be unsettling for some, even if they can't express what it is they're unsettled about. Do you think that we're destined to deal with this dichotomy in perpetuity, or do you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Mike, I walk in love and hope. It's something that I say. I sign all my books that way. I sign off to my radio show that way. I signed off when I was working with Tom, and I believe in that. I mean, I think that it's real. And if you believe in hope, if you are optimistic, and this doesn't mean that I have sort of this love and these sort of fuzzy, gooey sentimentalities, but I believe that we are fundamentally good people. I believe this is fundamentally a wonderful nation. I believe that people want to see each other as human beings and not as accidents of or, you know, the lottery of what their skin, their height, their sexual orientation may be. So my answer to that question has to be yes. I mean, in order for me to continue to do this work and to believe in it and to bring children into this world. You have two wonderful sons, boys that I brought into this world. I have to believe that it won't be in perpetuity. However, I don't think, as many wanted it to be, that we somehow had reached a post-racial society because we elected President Obama, that we now didn't have to have conversations about race or that race is passé or that many say that they're fatigued about these issues of race. So I don't think that we are there. Obviously, we are all witness to what's been going on, and people have been hitting the streets around everything that's happened from Ferguson to New York to Cleveland. And I would be remiss if I didn't speak of that. So it's hard to have that conversation, and it's hard for me to have the conversation with many of my students about whether we're post-racial, whether inequality is over, where are we going, whether this issue is ever going to go away. I mean, how do you really have that conversation when you have the backdrop of what we've been experiencing in all of these places? So it's sad. It's hard. But it's important work that we need to do. And I think that we'll get there.
You know, I'm not sure how to phrase this question, so I'm just going to stumble through it. When President Obama was running the first time for president, a lot of people felt that wouldn't it be wonderful if we elected a black president, because that would mean that we have crossed a hurdle. We've mm-hmm. reached a milestone, and things will change. The building blocks that we've been standing on will crumble, and a new era will dawn. And I kept thinking, you know, his mother is white. His father is black, but his mother is white. But automatically, we identify him as a black president, an African-American president. And that attitude, it seems to me, dates back to the one-drop rule, where you have one drop of African-American blood in you, then you are black. You're a Negro. Is that a problem in the African-American community, is identity? Because there's a lot of that in the African-American community that goes unacknowledged, and it's certainly unacknowledged in the white community to a large extent. Is that a problem? Does it matter?
I think that, no, I don't think it's a problem. I don't think that that many, and I can't speak for everyone in the African community.
And that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Exactly.
You get a black person on the show who's a noted person, and they have to speak for everybody in the community.
Exactly. But I think that I think it's interesting, this one drop. And people, I don't think people know about the history, but a brief history on the one drop. It was first implemented, obviously, during slavery. And it was done so that any child that was born to a white male slave owner and with a black female slave would legally be identified as black. Right. Mm-hmm. So as a result, they would have no right to property or any other wealth holdings of the white father. And the United States abolished slavery. We're happy about that. But then southern states, such as places like Tennessee or Louisiana and others, they decided that they were going to legalize this rule, this one drop rule. And so it continued, and it continued all the way up until 1967, when we had the Loving v. Virginia case, which was the United States actually overturning the ban on interracial marriage. The one drop rule also lost its legal legitimacy. So I think it's interesting. The brief history on it is quite interesting. I think what has happened, and we've seen people who have found this, is identity is a tricky thing. I mean, how you identify yourself versus how the world identifies you is always been a very tricky thing. And I don't think that it's necessarily just because of the one drop rule. I think, you know, the history tells us that. But back to W.E.B. Du Bois. I mean, Du Bois and Souls of Black Folks talked a lot about the veil and essentially what that means. I mean, in one of my classes, we do a lot of focusing on the veil. And even in my media imaging classes, we do. Because it's the struggle between a group's projected image of themselves versus the image being projected on them. And so, I mean, those discussions are tough discussions, and they're tricky discussions and tricky debates. And so I think that it's complicated, and it's complicated for a myriad of reasons, but I don't think that it, for the African-American community, is any more difficult to say that we don't understand who we are, because I think most black folk understand who they are, and most black folk, like our president, what he said, which I think that most interracial couples who have children say, is that I'm black. And it's not just because of the one drop rule. I mean, we can have theoretical conversations about this, but it's because when I stand on the corner in any of these major cities and try to hail a cab, and he talked about this, I have a difficult time doing that because the rest of society sees me as black. So I think that children or parents of children who are multiracial, while they acknowledge often that, you know, my mom is white, my mother is Asian, my father is black, they understand, these parents understand how the world is going to see their child. And so I think that we've seen where these families say, my child is black. But it doesn't mean that my child is not black with a rich cultural history and a cultural present. And so I bring to bear all of those things. I bring their whiteness to. I talk to them about, you know, they see their mothers, they see their grandmothers, they see that side of the family, and they understand that. And I think it brings a richness to that individual child's experience and that family's experience, but it brings a richness to our country and sort of the multicultural country that we are. The paradigmatic shift that we had, you know, many generations or at least two generations ago when we were looking at a black and white paradigm has shifted. And we are looking more at a multicultural paradigm that is impacted by interracial marriages and interracial relationships.
But
isn't that adding
to the unease that a lot of people feel and some of the tension that we are witnessing here around the country, because the country is changing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the people like Pat Buchanan, for example, he's wrote a book on, you know, sort of the death of a superpower. Yeah. I mean, people are uncomfortable. And I understand that. I understand that if you are used to a certain way of understanding and viewing your existence, if you look at our national identity as whiteness primarily, and everything else is other, and you happen to be the beneficiary of that construct, then I understand that it gets uncomfortable. It gets scary. The power that may be shifting, it's fear playing. But I don't believe that any of us can be overtaken by our fear or our discomfort or our anxiety. And the truth of the matter for me ultimately is their fear and their anxiety and their discomfort, while I understand it, it's still not my problem. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be ways in which they, others, have to deal with that and understand where the country and where the world is going.
You know, you and others talk about privilege and how white people have been the beneficiaries of privilege since the very beginnings of Western civilization, actually. And a lot of people believe that one of the problems with race is that white people simply refuse to acknowledge the privilege of color and the privilege that grants them in society. And yet, if you go to those who are struggling, white middle-class people who are losing ground, they would argue that privilege doesn't stand for all that much. We're losing the middle class. And among the people in the middle class are a lot of white people who feel disenfranchised, who feel frightened because economically they are not thriving anymore. They are stagnating or losing ground. So, and yet we have this unease that you just mentioned of people somewhat beneath their skin acknowledging that, gee, things are changing and maybe I'm going to lose status. How do you reconcile mm-hmm. those things?
I think that it's understanding white privilege. Sort of what is the definition? Understanding more about how we learn, how white folks learned to be white. Learning about some of the accumulated advantages that have resulted in whites faring better than people of color. And also identifying the cost of the system to white people and what can what they can do to change things. And so understanding the definition of white privilege and seeing white privilege, that it's about the concrete benefits of access to resources and social rewards. And it's the power. That's an important word there. It's the power to shape the norms and the values of society. And this is a power that whites receive. And, quite frankly, many, most, receive it unconsciously by virtue of their skin color in a racist society. And I think that part of it is this kind of understanding of what privilege is. And privilege isn't always just about money. I mean, it's sort of the same conversation I would have about inequality. While economics is a huge part of it, and because we live in this bastion of capitalism, that's how we oftentimes understand it. But, you know, Peggy Mac McIntosh does a lot of work on this issue of white privilege, and she really sort of started talking about it. And she says that every white person gets this without even realizing. It's what people say is the wages of whiteness. And so it's not saying that you get more money. It's just saying that there's certain things, there are many things, not just certain things. There's many things that you know, most people, there are numerous privileges that most white people take for granted. I mean, ranging from serious police aggression and brutality, right, and the abuse, to seldom having to think about a flesh-colored Band-Aid. I mean, there really are small things that everyone else, the white folks just don't even recognize.
Yeah, I was going to bring Peggy McIntosh up because I know that you use her in your classes.
I do. I use her in my classes, and I have to say I like Peggy a lot as a person. I've worked with her a lot in Connecticut, the work that she's done around white privilege and around building. She also has this wonderful program called the SEED Project, which is a national project that she has brought to many independent schools to be able to talk about these issues of diversity and issues of inclusion. And so I think very highly of what Peggy is doing, because I'll harken back to one of the things I said earlier. We all have roles to play. in this work that we're doing and in making our country as good as it can be, as good as its promise. And Peggy, different than me because she happens to be a white woman as opposed to an African-American woman, she's figured out what her role to play is at this particular juncture.
Because I wanted to quote a couple of things that she writes about, and I wanted to find out who she was before I did that. How would you describe Peggy McIntosh? Because I'm not familiar with her.
Yeah, I mean, I think she would probably describe herself as a sociologist. She works up at Wellesley. She's associate director of the Wellesley College Center for Research on Women, and she started these essays about white privilege and male privilege, and it really came out of her work that she was doing around male privilege, and it became this personal account of her seeing. How males really are privileged and they don't realize it. And then she started thinking. She said, well, you know, through the work and the studies that I was doing around this, I started realizing that this is similar to white privilege. And therefore, I'm a part of this problem as well. And so I think that she, you know, she's an academic to some extent. She works in colleges, but she's on the ground doing this work. And she's, I think, a committed, a convicted, and a compassionate person.
One of the things she says, she writes about, she says, I've come to see white privilege as an invisible package of unearned assets that I can count on cashing in each day, but about which I was meant to remain oblivious. White privilege is like an invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks. As a white person, I realized I had been taught about racism as something that puts others at a disadvantage, but had been taught not to see one of its corollary aspects, white privilege, which puts me at an advantage.
And I think that's well put and interestingly said. I mean, it's funny, Mike, you bring this up, and Peggy can speak to this because that's her lived experience. Mm-hmm. I have students oftentimes who say to me, we do have some other readings about sort of switching identities and switching races. And students say to me, I really wish I could just take a day to sit in a room where white people are talking between and amongst themselves and really know what they're saying and how that feels. And I think that that Peggy captures it there, that it is something that people don't even realize. And she also lists a bunch of different things that really speak to this, that these are the conditions that folks don't realize. If she says that, you know, if I should need to move from a house, I can pretty much be sure of renting or purchasing a house in any area which I can afford and which I want to live in. She talks about that. She talks about being able to publish the pieces that she has. It's just things that she realizes that she takes for granted.
And simple things. I have that list in my hand. Simple things.
Good. Like good. Then I don't have to try to remember it.
I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. Mm. Let me see. I can turn on television or open the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. When I am told about our national heritage or about civilization, I'm shown that people of my color made it what it is.
And that's extraordinarily important,
yes,
right?
Yes.
It's extraordinarily important because it talks about images and these images and what we see. I mean, you know, at this age and even at the college age, you may be able to have reasonable and rational discussions and critical thinking about this. But when you're 5, when you're 6, even when you're 10, and this is what you're bombarded with, so you start thinking, you know, people tell me a lot of things, but why don't people who look like me stand in front of the classroom? Why don't people who look like me, why aren't they on the front of the New York Times or on the front of, you know, the New Haven Register? And I think that that's important and it's impactful and it has a lot to do with why having President Barack Obama as an African-American man, leader of the free world, and more importantly, having Michelle Obama and his 2 children as the first family that's African Americans, because that image itself speaks volumes to generations to come.
We're talking to Stephanie Robinson, president of the Jamestown Project, a lecturer at Harvard Law, and we're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and ExploreBoone.com with skiing, snowboarding, tubing, and other outdoor activities for adventurers of all ages. More winter adventure ideas at ExploreBoone.com. UN.com. The UN is pressing Nigerian officials to investigate a possible mass killing by Boko Haram militants, the brutal insurgency, and new calls for international intervention, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation right now, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back with more of our conversation with Stephanie Robinson. Stay with us.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo, Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for Morning Edition weekday mornings from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Stephanie Robinson, the president of the Jamestown Project, a lecturer at Harvard Law School, a frequent contributor, at least in the past, to the Tom Joyner Morning Show, and worked with Tavis Smiley on a number of projects. She's coming to town January 22nd. Information about that is on our website, because part of that visit is open to the public. WFAE.org is where you can find it. Race equality and what we can do about it is what she'll be talking about. And we have often heard that, and we've just kind of talked about this in a roundabout way, that there are two Americas, black and white. We each race experiences the country in a different way because of the experiences that they confront every day. Can there be a resolution to the racial issues that we face in this country in the absence of each group being able to understand the other's experience? And how can we ever do that?
I think that empathy is extraordinarily important. I describe myself as part of this identity conversation continued as an empath, and it's a blessing and it's a curse. But I think that in order for us to move past where we are nationally with this conversation, is that we do have to do more understanding, more stepping in shoes, more listening. And I think that that piece of it is really important. You know, one thing that I talk about in my courses, and one of the things that I do in starting out all of the courses that I teach, period, but particularly the courses that involve the issues of race, is this sort of ground rule. I call it my housekeeping rules. And it always stresses at the outset that the subject of race in America is a difficult, thorny, and emotional discussion. It's one that people sort of figure that they know where they stand already. They're bringing that baggage into the conversation. And truly, they don't want to hear too much about anybody challenging what they think are their thoughts. And mm-hmm. So I get to see this microcosm of what's happening.
Is that happening on both sides, by the way?
It's happening on both sides.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It happens on both sides. And people think that we're going to continue to just have the conversations that they always have, and they can take their position on immigration and they can argue that. And what I say at the onset, and I continue it throughout, and this is the same kind of thing that I do going into communities to have these conversations, is that I want to have a discussion that is honest and that is open. And part of that is that you all need to act as adults. You know, we're here to be adults. We're here to respect one another. But make no mistake about it, I want to make sure that you are able to ask and observe and say things that you think may not be politically correct, that may be stupid, that may not be even important or may be obvious. And I say to the other side, and particularly when I'm dealing with people of color, I say to them, and I don't want the body language either. I don't want the rolling of the eyes to stop and shut down conversation. But I happen to teach law students, so I have the benefit of having to say to them, you got to buck up. I mean, you know, you got to have a little thicker skin with this stuff, and you have to be thoughtful about what you bring to the table. But I still think that even in that microcosm and sort of talking about it, that what I have been able to do, and I've done this and I've heard about it. I heard about it after the decisions came down in Ferguson and then what happened in New York. I got calls from all over the country and text messages and emails from a lot of my former students saying, Professor, I just thank you so much for the class and for the opportunity and the off class and out of class conversations you allowed me to have with you, because it has given me a basis to have this discussion right now without just having it through the lenses of rage and anger and being only having the discussion only through that lens of emotion. And so, Mike, I think that part of what needs to happen and has to happen is that we have to break through what we think we know. We have to break through the emotion, and you got to go through it. I mean, you can't just say, okay, well, I'm not going to be emotional about it. I mean, mm-hmm. think about your child kicking and screaming because they can't go somewhere. I mean, they're not going to be like, okay, I'm not going to be emotional about that. You are. And so you can't deny that as emotions, but the emotions can't shut down the conversation. And I think a lot of times that's what happens. So my offer and my advice to how we start dealing with these issues is that we deal with them from an individual and micro perspective. There are things that we can do there, the conversations that we need to have, the responsibility that we take upon ourselves as individuals to talk to people, to live in different places, to live amongst people, to have dinner and lunch and friends and acquaintances of different races and different persuasions. That we also, we can't forget to work on the issues that need to happen at the national and at the policy level.
But that's so hard to do. I mean, one of the pluses of integration was supposed to be intermingling, exposure to each other, seeing that we're more alike than we are different. And so we have this several generations now of kids who go to school together, kids who go out into the workforce together. They see each other all day, every day. But then they go home and cocoon in their own environments, among people like themselves, black and white. It happens on Sunday morning, particularly in churches, but it happens in social situations as well. So, how do you change that?
I don't think that you have to change that. I guess you're assuming that I think that is not necessarily a bad thing. I don't think that there's a problem with people having spaces where they are able to connect with people that they feel comfortable with and that they feel familiar with. I don't think that is the problem. I mean, we don't have segregation in that sense. I don't think we'll have that at all. I think what the problem is not the division at certain times of the day. I mean, quite frankly, if you're in school or at work with someone, I mean, that oxygen that you're breathing is more than half of your day. I mean, you're spending more than half of your time there. So I don't think that's necessarily the problem. I think that the problem happens when you have people who have racist tendencies, who when racism, whether it's individual racism or institutional and systemic racism, rears its ugly head. I mean, when you have people who work in stereotypes, I mean, that's when the problem comes, when these negative emotions happen and they actually oppress individuals or whole groupings. But I do think, and I think that in these places, I mean, you talked about schools and places where people can have these conversations, and I think that they are happening in a lot of schools. I mean, I mentioned the SEED project that is going on. It's one that that's happening in quite frankly, in my child's school right now at in Weston, Massachusetts. And this project is one that, you know, seeks to bring people together, parents and guardians, to discuss topics of social importance for personal growth and introspection. And so you're at this school, you're at this place, and if you're doing the work where you focus on equipping us parents as well as, our the guardians in raising our children to just be more aware, to be more empowered as global citizens, and you do this through readings, and you do this through activities, you do this through film. And if you're doing these types of projects, I think that they're important. And Mike, I know you want to get in here, but I want to say one other thing. And, I think that there's a piece of this. We haven't talked about King yet, but there's something that you talked about where it's, you know, more of people being together. I think that one of the things that we need to caution ourselves about, and particularly when we're looking at some of these plights that are going on, and I think the King was prophetic when he said this. He talked about that what we need to pay attention to is this this psychological liberation. And I think that it's part of his legacy. And what I mean by that is in 67, King gave a speech. It was his final address to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And I think that it drew a powerful link between racism and psychological health of black people. It was in response to a question, where do we go from here? And it's part of sort of the question that you're asking to some extent. And he said, first, we must massively assert our dignity and our worth. And I think that people need to listen. He talked about this false sense of inferiority that plagues the black community. And he pointed to the need for us as a people to regain our psychological freedom. He said any movement that the Negro is going to do that overlooks this necessity is waiting to be buried. I mean, that's how strong his words were on all of this. And so to me on this, as with many issues with King, he's prophetic. There's a growing body of evidence that the black community is in emotional distress that's brought about by historical and some of these continuing traumas that we have that are due to racism and dehumanizing consequences. So it's part of why I say that it's important, because when you see signs of distress like the fact that homicide, it's the leading cause of death for young black men, then when you see this consistent decline in both the number of longevity of black marriages, when you see the disproportionate number of African Americans who are incarcerated, you see all of this and you realize there is something that is afoot, that this lie, this root cause of many of the problems that are plaguing the black community, at least, lie in this lie of black inferiority. And there are people who are doing work around them. I mean, this is not sort of mumbo jumbo. I mean, I think King said it, but you also have the black psychologist who have done work, who have evidenced this, that this lie that was introduced a long time ago, that it's undermining our physical, our psychological, our families, our community's well-being. So it's why I caution to say that it's all about sort of just integration. I think there's some work that has to go on. The Community Healing Network is doing a lot of work around this, and they're in collaboration and saying there's some healing that needs to go on here. There's culturally grounded, evidence-based support that groups can come together, and they need to come together intra-race as well as inter-race to do some of this work. So I that's why I caution to say I'm not afraid for white folks to get together or for black folks to get together or for Asian folks to get together. I'm not afraid of that. What I'm saying is that can and should happen, and the work should be done, and the other work should be done. It should be a both-and approach. Mm.
Do you think that one of the elements of the conversation that needs to be had has to do with black males? It's never been easy to be black in America. It's particularly difficult to be a black male in America, particularly a young black male in America. And in light of Ferguson and other recent incidents, we hear about black men having to tell their sons how to conduct themselves around police officers or in public so that they won't be the victim of a situation like that. And there's a lot of stereotypes connected to being black and male in America, some of which engender fear. Where does that come from? How do you reverse it? How do young black men deal with that in the meantime?
No, I mean, you know, that's a very complicated set of issues and the question. And, you know, you said black men. I mean, as a black mother, I have to say that to two black boys, I feel like I've just sustained another blow. Another blow to the psyche, you know, this grand jury. And I think people need to hear that. I mean, you know, another grand jury told our children that their lives don't matter. Here we are again with another string of messages just telling us that the lives of black people are not as valuable as the lives of other people. And so I understand the frustration, and it's really difficult, particularly at this time when it's so fresh with us, when you know that the mere historical accident of the color of skins predicts that blacks between the ages of 18 and 24, 21 times more likely than their white counterparts to be shot and killed by a police officer. And so, you know, something is just radically wrong with this. And it speaks to our justice system. It speaks to our ideal of what we expect when we talk about equal justice under the law. And so I think that question is a tough question because you're right. It's not merely what black families have to tell their black children. And it's painful. It's painful to say that I have to tell you to act a certain way. I mean, I talked to my 13-year-old about this when it happened, but it's painful in the aftermath of these killings and even before these killings that, you know, we have to tell our children that, you know, don't put your hands up. Don't move too quick if a police officer comes in your way. Make sure that you're dressed in a certain way. I mean, one of my students was telling me whenever he even walks in Cambridge, he makes sure that he has on a jacket and a tie so that he's not stopped. So, I mean, this stuff is tough stuff. And I don't know how you tell somebody not to be afraid of someone, if in fact that is the case. You know, that's making the assumption that is in fact the case. And yes, there's some fear issues around this, but it also has to do with the media's depiction. It has to do with the narrative that we keep telling ourselves about what black men are and what they are not. It has to do, again, with this lie of black inferiority and that, you know, what black men are able to do, what they're worthy to do. And that, I think, if we change some of the narrative and we're able to do that by the images that we see and how we see black men, that the psyche and the understanding of who they are and that they are that they're nuanced, right? You know, every black man isn't like every white man. They're nuanced and that they are seen and valued for who they are and not some caricature of what you think them to be. That's the work that we have to do. And I think a lot of that work, Mike, has to happen really from an imaging perspective. A lot of work should be happening with media and with that type of work, because I talk to people from around the country, and before they come to this country, their idea of what blackness is, in particular, what black men are, is shaped and formed early on by the images that they see coming across their screens, both in new media and old.
We don't really have time for you to answer this question, but I want to share this question with you because David E. has emailed it to us. Isn't it also racist not to acknowledge the plethora of races in our country? I have not heard much talk about Hispanics, American Indians, Asians. Why are you only talking about a black-white issue? And you do talk about that when you make your speeches and when you make your talks around the country, don't you?
I absolutely do, and I talk about it in my class. I talked about anti-immigration issues, and I talked about it here in saying that we have moved from a black-white paradigm, and we have shifted to a multicultural, multiracial paradigm.
And that's part of the discomfort that we're experiencing in America at the moment, and part of the discomfort over immigration. Stephanie Robinson will be in town January 22nd. You can have information about that on our website. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing everyone.